So when you picture a green future, you probably see like a very specific, carefully curated image,
Oh,
right?
totally. Sleek, silent electric cars gliding down perfectly paved roads.
Exactly. Massive white wind turbines spinning against a cloudless blue sky. It's this world powered by invisible data and clean energy.
And it feels like a massive relief.
It really does. It feels like we finally figured out the math, and just stopped hurting the planet.
But what if that sleek green future is actually, well, just a high-tech mask for the exact same destruction we've been causing for centuries?
Yeah, that is the big question. In this deep dive, we're unpacking a really provocative research and curatorial proposal by Galea Morato-Loredo.
Right. It's titled From Sacrifice Zones to Cultivation Grounds.
And the subtitle is Multi-Species Ontology and the Curatorial Practice of Mutual Nurturance. So today, our mission is to rethink our relationship with the planet, technology, and honestly, time itself.
Yeah, the central goal of this text is to challenge our fundamental understanding of progress. It asks how we can transition from simply like documenting the collapse of our environment to actually growing something new in its place using art and ancestral wisdom.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to even begin, we really have to dismantle that comforting illusion of the green transition.
We do, because the prevailing narrative tells us that we're simply swapping out a dirty engine for a clean one, right?
Right, and then we can just keep driving the exact same way we always have.
Exactly. But Morato-Loredo's research shatters that completely. She points out this glaring, honestly terrifying paradox at the heart of our modern environmentalism.
Which is what
Well,
exactly?
we celebrate the shift away from fossil fuels, but we completely ignore the reality of what is replacing them. The current energy transition is not a reduction in our impact.
Or
It's actually an exponential acceleration in the sheer scale and velocity of material consumption.
because the pillars of our future economy, artificial intelligence, electromobility, massive global data infrastructures, they don't run on magic.
No, they absolutely do not. They require an unimaginable volume of physical extracted earth.
I mean, we call it the cloud to make it sound weightless and ethereal, you know.
Yeah, the cloud.
But the cloud is actually like a millions of square feet server farm sitting in a desert somewhere, drinking millions of gallons of fresh water just to keep its processors from literally melting down.
Right, and an electric vehicle might not have a tailpipe, but building its battery requires hollowing out mountains for lithium and cobalt.
Which brings us to one of the most powerful concepts the author introduces, the digital Baroque.
Yes, the digital Baroque. So if we look back at the historical Baroque period in like 17th century Europe, its defining characteristic was this overwhelming, ornate aesthetic of excess.
Think of those towering cathedrals entirely coated in gold leaf or wildly elaborate marble sculptures.
Exactly. That aesthetic was deliberately designed to project divine power, but it was entirely sustained by the brutal, hidden extraction of wealth, minerals, and human labor from colonized lands in the Americas.
So the gold shimmering on a European ceiling was physically dug out of the Andean mountains at an unspeakable human and ecological cost.
Right. The luxury of the viewer depended completely on them being an ocean away from the violence of the mind.
And the author argues that the digital Baroque operates on that exact same mechanism, right?
Yes, precisely. Today, our colonial ornamentation isn't a gold leaf cathedral. It's a multi-billion dollar space tourism mission.
Wow, yeah.
It's generative AI models that consume as much electricity as sovereign nations just to produce like a synthetic image. It's an aesthetic of frictionless, sleek technological excess built on the exact same foundation of invisible extraction.
So true luxury in the modern age isn't gold. It's the invisibility of the violence required to power our lives. I
Absolutely.
mean, it's like buying a massive 3-ton electric Hummer, right? And showing it off to your neighbors as this big win for the environment while remaining completely insulated from the landscape that had to be destroyed to create it. Is sustainability just becoming a high-tech smokescreen for the same old greed?
What's fascinating here is how the author connects this modern excess to a broader philosophical movement known as accelerationism.
Okay, what is accelerationism?
Well, thinkers in this space, and we're just reporting on their ideas here, whether it's Nick Land on the right or Nick Sternecik and Alex Williams on the left, they operate on a shared, unquestioned assumption
Which is?
that time is entirely compressible and that speed is the ultimate virtue.
Oh, I see. And the entire tech industry really runs on this. Faster processing power, faster supply chains, instant global delivery.
Exactly. The goal is always to eliminate friction and wait times entirely.
But Morato-Loredo argues that this obsession with speed inherently exercises violence upon matter, right?
Yes. Because the physical Earth cannot be infinitely compressed or accelerated. A forest takes decades to grow. A mineral takes millennia to form.
So the logic of the digital Baroque demands that we force the physical world to match the speed of a fiber optic cable.
Right, and the only way to do that is to rip the material Earth apart.
Which brings up a massive conceptual wall for us.
Yeah.
If the root of our ecological crisis is this violent, unnatural obsession with speed, then we can't solve it just by inventing a better battery.
No, we really can't. We have to fundamentally alter how we experience reality and time.
Okay, so how do we do that?
This is where the research brings in the anthropologist Eduardo Viveiros de Castro and his concept of multinaturalism.
Multinaturalism. Okay, tell me about that.
Well, to understand it, we have to look at how Western thought usually operates, which is through multiculturalism. In the West, we assume there is one single objective physical reality.
One nature, essentially.
Right, one nature. And there are simply many different human cultures that have different opinions or interpretations of it.
So, one Earth. Many human perspectives on that Earth.
Exactly. But multinaturalism, which is drawn from Amerindian cosmologies, completely flips that framework. It proposes a plurality of natures.
A plurality of natures. What does that mean in practice?
Viveiros de Castro uses the example of a jaguar. In Western thought, a human and a jaguar look at blood. The human sees blood while the jaguar just interprets it as a tasty drink.
Okay.
But in multinaturalism, because a jaguar has a fundamentally different physical body and sensory apparatus, it inhabits a fundamentally different physical world.
Wait, really?
Yeah. For the jaguar, the blood literally is beer. Their physical reality is distinct from ours.
Wow. So it's not a difference of opinion, it is a difference of physics, of lived reality.
Exactly. And if bodies dictate reality, then they also dictate the experience of time. The author captures this perfectly when she says, "The time of a mountain is not the time of a hummingbird."
The time of a mountain is not the time of a hummingbird. That is such a striking image.
It's the core conflict. Think about it. A hummingbird's heart beats over 1,000 times a minute.
Yeah, it's so fast.
Its reality is this high-speed blur of immediate nectar extraction. But a mountain's reality is geological. A century is a single breath.
So the violence of the digital Baroque happens because the modern tech industry is essentially a hummingbird trying to force a mountain to operate on a hummingbird's metabolic schedule.
That is exactly it.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because I'm listening to this, and a massive red flag is going up for me.
Oh, what kind of red flag?
Well, the concept of mountain time and multinaturalism comes directly from indigenous living heritage, right?
Right, it does.
But we see scholars like Zoe Todd and Kim Tallbear constantly warning about academic extractivism.
Right, the idea of mining indigenous thought.
Exactly. An academic flies into a community, learns an indigenous concept, strips it of its actual cultural context, and publishes it in a Western journal as a trendy new theoretical framework just to get tenure.
It's a huge issue in academia.
Right. So how do we and how does the listener respect this living heritage without just stealing the concept to sound enlightened at dinner parties?
It is a critical danger, and intellectual extraction is just as violent as mineral extraction.
Exactly.
But Murato Laredo avoids this trap through her methodology. She explicitly states that she is not importing these cosmologies from the outside to use as an academic tool.
So it's personal for her.
Very.
Yeah.
She inhabits them as embodied cultural memory. This is her living heritage. And her proposal is not to write another passive theoretical paper about the mountain's time.
Oh, so she's actually putting it into practice.
Exactly. She is proposing that we operate these cosmologies as a living, tangible practice.
But human brains aren't wired to feel mountain time, you know?
Yeah.
We only really react to immediate visible threats.
Yeah.
So how do you force a modern human, comfortable in the digital Baroque, to truly feel the violence of a timescale they literally can't comprehend?
Well, you strip away the opacity, you make the hidden complicity completely visible.
How so?
Murato Laredo does this by moving from abstract theory into the physical space of the art gallery. She uses curatorial practice to assault the senses and force a confrontation.
Oh, wow. Yeah, she details a trilogy of curatorial projects in the research. And these are not like quiet rooms with landscape paintings on white walls.
Not at all.
The first project is called Waka.
Right. Waka explores the sonic, political, and ontological dimensions of extractivism in the Andean territories.
The sonic dimensions, like what it sounds
like. Yeah. Instead of giving you a chart of mining statistics, it forces you to experience how modern infrastructure functions practically as a new religion.
A new religion. That's intense.
It explores the auditory footprint of extraction, the hum of the servers, the blasts of the mines, and exposes how this technological infrastructure reproduces the old colonial evangelizing logic.
So it imposes itself on indigenous bodies and cosmologies, basically demanding total faith and physical sacrifice.
Exactly. It's unquestionable.
And if Waka is about the sound of extraction, the second project, Triangle of Sacrifice, is about the physical reality of it. The author describes it as an epistemological device that destroys and mutates matter in real time.
Yes. This isn't a photograph of a landfill in a distant country. The gallery physically breaks down electronics and minerals right in front of the viewer.
Right in the room. You smell the chemicals. You watch the sleek, user-friendly interface of our modern devices literally melt away into the toxic elements that comprise them.
And the psychological toll of that project is what makes it so vital. By placing the destruction inside the closed room with the viewer, it eliminates the geographical distance that usually protects us.
Right, you can't look away.
Exactly. You are no longer allowed to be a passive, sympathetic observer. The gallery forces you to recognize that you are an accomplice to the ruin happening right in front of you.
Imagine walking into an art gallery, and instead of looking at a painting of a ruined forest, the gallery is literally chewing up the earth right in front of you.
It's confronting.
It's like turning on the fluorescent lights at a party where everyone was quietly breaking things in the dark. Suddenly, nobody can pretend they don't see the mess.
That is a great way to put it.
And that leads directly to the final piece of the trilogy, Rare Earths, which functions as an open score.
Right. Rare Earths is a massive mapping of the global logistics chain.
Tracing everything back.
Exactly. It forces the viewer to trace a continuous, unbroken line starting from the lithium and salt flats of the Andes, moving through the cobalt mines of Africa, tracking across the industrial manufacturing sectors in Asia, and finally landing squarely on the smartphone in the consumer's pocket.
Wow. So it eliminates the opacity of global production. It forcefully brings extraction, manufacturing, and consumption into a single, undeniable dialogue.
Yes. The ultimate goal of all three projects is to completely strip away the user-friendly interface of global capitalism.
But there's a specific geographical detail here that stands out to me. The author is taking these deeply Andean indigenous concepts, but she's centering her curatorial research in the Netherlands. Why focus these confrontational experiments on Dutch institutions?
Because the Netherlands is the ultimate beneficiary of the digital Baroque. Geographically and economically, it operates as a massive critical node within global extractive supply chains.
Oh, like the Port of Rotterdam.
Exactly. It's the largest seaport in Europe, moving millions of tons of extracted global materials. And think of the country's tax structures that host the corporate entities of massive global tech firms.
So the Dutch system is structurally implicated in the very violence the author is critiquing. They are basically the central nervous system for the logistics of the digital Baroque.
They are. But simultaneously, Dutch society possesses an institutional landscape, museums, funding bodies, legal frameworks that is uniquely capable of demanding transparency.
Oh, I see. Because they have the resources and the stability.
Right. They are fertile ground to experiment with what Murato Laredo calls social choreographies.
Social choreographies, meaning redesigning the literal logistics and physical interactions between people, systems, and the earth.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, this aligns with what scholar Colin Sterling defines as critical creative heritage praxis.
Critical creative heritage praxis. Unpack that for us.
Sure. In a traditional Western museum, heritage is about taking an old indigenous pot, putting it behind glass, and preserving a dead past.
You're like saving old things.
Right. But in critical creative praxis, heritage isn't just saving old things. It is an active living field. It is a space where the past and present are negotiated collectively and where multi-species cosmologies are used to figure out how we restructure our society today.
Okay, so the fluorescent lights are on. The art trilogy has forced the viewer to confront the global supply chain, the destruction of matter, and their own complicity.
Yes, the damage is visible.
We are bearing full witness to the devastation. But the core mission of this deep dive was to figure out how we move from merely witnessing the sacrifice zones to actually cultivating something new.
And that transition requires a completely new methodology, One, that the author sources from the ancestral knowledge of Andean indigenous nations, specifically systematized by Elvira Espero Aica.
Right, and it's the practice of Yanakiwanya.
Yes, Yanakiwanya, or mutual nurturance.
Mutual nurturance. How does that actually work?
Well, Yanakiwanya requires us to fundamentally abandon the Western concept of industrial production. In the digital Baroque, creation means manufacturing a static object. You mine the lithium, build the battery, sell the car, and the process is finished.
Right, it's transactional.
Exactly. But Yanakiwanya views creation as accompaniment. A weaver in the Andes does not just make a textile.
What do they do?
The weaver raises the alpacas. They tend to the local plants used for dye. They understand the changing weather patterns.
Oh, wow.
So the final textile is not a disposable product. It is a physical record of an ongoing living relationship with an entire ecosystem.
It's the difference between buying a proprietary software program in a shrink wrap box versus contributing to an open source coding project.
That's a great analogy.
The open source project is never totally finished. It is gestated. It is constantly maintained, patched, and evolved by the community that uses it. The bond between the creators and the creation is ongoing.
Yes, and that logic of fertility where trial, adaptation, and slow growth are the foundation of the bond is deeply tied to philosopher Yokui's concept of cosmotechnics.
Cosmotechnics.
Yeah. We argues that we need to stop thinking of technology with a capital T as one universal inevitable march toward AI and data centers.
Right, like it's just this one-way street.
Exactly. He argues that every tool a culture invents is simply an expression of that culture's cosmology.
So because Western culture views the earth purely as a dead resource, it invents monotechnics.
Yes. Tools like internal combustion engines and massive server farms designed purely for maximum extraction and speed.
But if we embrace technodiversity, the reality that there are many ways of understanding the universe, we can invent completely different technical paradigms.
Exactly. If your cosmology views the mountain as a living relative, you will inevitably design technologies that nurture that relationship rather than hollow it out.
Okay, wait, hold on. I hear the beauty in this. Open source adaptation, the logic of fertility, taking the time to gestate a relationship with the ecosystem.
Right.
But we are facing a ticking clock climate crisis. The oceans are warming, forests are burning. We literally don't have time to slowly gestate a bond with the earth.
I know, it feels counterintuitive.
Doesn't this messy trial and error logic of fertility basically guarantee we lose the race against climate change? Can we really afford that when the world is practically screaming for instant, flawless technological fixes?
This raises an important question, and it addresses the absolute core of our modern anxiety. But the author's argument is that our desperation for an instant, flawless technological fix is the exact mechanism driving the crisis.
Wait, our desperation for a fix is the problem?
Yes. We are trying to use the tools of the digital Baroque speed, extraction, and infinite acceleration to solve the devastation caused by the digital Baroque.
Oh, I see.
You cannot put out a chemical fire by pouring more gasoline on it.
So we're basically trying to solve the problem of the hummingbirds by forcing the mountain to spin even faster.
Exactly. Addressing ecological collapse cannot just be a matter of switching fuel sources. It demands an ontological transformation.
We have to change our very definition of what is considered alive and what is considered valuable.
Right. Cultural institutions and museums must stop just archiving the past and our mistakes. They have to become the active spaces where we test out these new social choreographies, slowing down to the speed of the materials we rely on.
Which requires us to fundamentally break our modern perception of time. Because in the Western world, we think of time as a straight arrow.
A march of progress.
Exactly. We are always moving forward. The past is behind us, out of sight, useless, and the future is out there in front of us, like a blank frontier that we are rushing toward as fast as our processors can calculate.
But Mirado Loredo shares an incredibly profound alternative from Andean cosmology.
Yeah, and this blew my mind.
Time does not move in a straight line. It turns.
It turns.
The spatial orientation is completely inverted. In the Andean conception of time, you live the present walking backwards into the future.
Walking backwards into the future. Your eyes are fixed entirely on the past.
Because the past is what is visible. The past holds the lived experience, the consequences of your actions, the lessons of the ancestors, the memory of the landscape.
You can see it clearly.
Right. You can see it. The future is unknown. It is behind you. You do not rush toward it to conquer it. You carry the future on your back. moving carefully, and you care for it using the guidance of the past you are looking at.
That completely shatters the posture of humanity. Instead of blindly accelerating into the unknown, tearing apart the physical earth to achieve some theoretical green utopia, we move with the slow, deliberate pace of the mountain. We walk backwards, guided by memory, curing the future safely.
Yes.
So what does this all mean? The true insight of this deep dive isn't just that our data centers use too much water or that electric vehicles have dirty supply chains.
No, it's much deeper than that.
It's that the entire user-friendly interface of our modern world is designed to make us comfortable with violence. Shifting from sacrifice zones to cultivation grounds means tearing down that interface. It means recognizing that you cannot infinitely compress time without ripping the world apart.
It is an invitation to abandon the colonial demand for speed, to stop extracting, and to start accompanying the earth through the practice of mutual nurturance.
We started this conversation by talking about the sleek illusions of artificial intelligence. Systems currently built entirely on the philosophy of forward-moving speed, infinite data extraction, and the conquest of the future.
Right.
But if Yu Hui is right, and every technology simply expresses the cosmology of his creators, what would an artificial intelligence look like if its very code was built on the Andean concept of time?
Oh, wow.
What if we programmed a supercomputer not to predict and conquer the future, but to walk backwards into it, prioritizing the slow, deep memory of the mountain over the relentless, destructive speed of the machine? What kind of world would that intelligence build for us?
That is a profound thought.
Something for you to mull over and explore on your own. Keep digging deeper.